This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with author Sujatha Fernandez on her book, Who Can Stop the Drums? We talk about urban social movements in Chavez's Venezuela.
Some great perspective on what's happening in Venezuela. Yes, we have Chavez's anti-neoliberal model, but we also have incredible activism in grassroots community throughout Venezuela.
We'll talk with Professor John Tito Gerasi about his new book, Unrepentant Radical Educator.
You'll hear Gerasi's fascinating stories of journalism and activism. A man who knew Che, Fidel, Jerry Rubin, and Cleaver will talk to us about his remarkable experiences.
Stay with us. Urban Social Movements in Chavez's Venezuela is the title of Sujatha Fernandez's new book. Sujatha is an author and assistant professor of sociology at Queens College and the Graduate Center, City University of New York. Her book looks at the transformations underway in Venezuela that are shaped by negotiations between the Chavez government and social movements using their own forms of historical memory and local organization. Sujatha shows everyday life and politics in the shanty towns of Caracas from the perspective of community-based radio, barrio assemblies, and the many interviews she conducted with activists and government officials. Most of the barrio activists in the book are Chavez supporters. Sujatha is also the author of Cuba Represent, Cuban Arts, State Power, and the Making of New Revolutionary Cultures, also published by Duke University Press. Sujatha joins us in the studio today.
Sujatha, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you
well,
for having me on the
show.
You
put in a lot of time in Caracas, I know, and you've written this wonderful book, Who Can Stop the Drums? To us, Venezuela was a real breath of fresh air, with Chavez being elected and new possibilities opening up in the teeth of this wave of neoliberalism, which was just so terrible in its consequences worldwide. And things are changing there a little bit, but they're not the tyranny that some people say it is, and they're not the paradise that other people say it is. And what we so much appreciated about Who Can Stop the Drums is that it's so nuanced, and you really, when you read it, get a feel for the true picture there. Let me ask you this. In terms of neoliberalism, how would you describe Venezuela now under Chavez?
Well, the argument that I make in the book is that what we're seeing in Venezuela, like in other countries in Latin America, Bolivia, Ecuador, is that there's a real pushback against neoliberal reforms. And so people like Chavez, who came into office in 1998, have been pursuing an anti-neoliberal agenda, trying to reverse the privatizations, trying to extend the social welfare net, trying to give healthcare, education. Many of the reforms that they're engaged in are anti-neoliberal reforms. And I think this is what, for instance, most of the left has been focused on, is the anti-neoliberal projects of these left leaders. The argument that I make in the book sort of takes a little bit further to look not only at the national context in which Chavez is operating, but to look at the broader global context. And the argument that I'm making is that actually what Chavez has done is carved out a space within the economy to carry out his neoliberal reforms, but that he is operating in a broader neoliberal global market, and that what we find in Venezuela is a kind of hybrid state that is both contains both neoliberal and anti-neoliberal elements.
I thought that was one interesting part of the book. I mean, I agree that the left looks at it and say, well, this is a fight against neoliberalism, this is great. But what you do is really go into the community organizations and the community mm-hmm. groups, and you say, how are they dealing with this neoliberal structure? And then one of the points that I thought is key from my reading is that the anti-neoliberal push by Chavez and his group is within a world capitalist neoliberal structure, mm-hmm. and therefore it can only go so far. Mm-hmm. And then what is happening on the ground with community groups and mm-hmm. other groups? So why don't you talk a little bit about how you look at that? There's the Chavez government, there's the people with Chavez, and then there's mm-hmm. the groups you really spent a lot of time with in Venezuela.
Right, right. And that was really the purpose of the research. When I went to Venezuela, I felt like I was coming from what we receive in the news media here. Either you hear about Chavez or you hear about the opposition, and it's as if there's nothing in between. And my whole purpose of my research was to go and say, what is that in between? Who are these people, the people, the large majority that live in the shanty towns? What do they think? Are they, as we are led to believe here, all, you know, these kind of mindless followers of Chavez who don't really think about things and just, you know, see him as some kind of savior. And what I found was quite the opposite. What I found was many, many community-based organizations that date far before Chavez and actually will tell you that we were here before Chavez. And they date back from the guerrilla movements against the dictatorship in the 1950s to the liberation theology movements, to the guerrilla movements, to just cultural and community-based organizations that emerged even in the 90s. And all of these groups trace their trajectory to a long period of struggle against different regimes in Venezuela. And what they've done under Chavez, I think that they've found themselves being very reinvigorated. And Chavez, with his, you know, the language that he speaks appeals to people. And many people have joined these community-based organizations and they've received a real breath of fresh air through Chavez, but they don't necessarily always agree with his agenda. And so this is where we see this kind of process of what I'm calling this negotiation between community-based groups and the state to say, you know, we have you in office, you represent our interests, and we've voted you into power, but you have to carry out, you know, what we have voted you in to do. And
can you give us some examples of that?
Sure. So one example that I look at in the book is community-based media. And communications is one of these areas that I refer to as, you know, at the crux of both the local kind of community-based media and the crux of the global economy. Communications is a key industry, very important for the Venezuelan economy and very tied into a global economy and a global market. And so the argument that I make is, well, these community-based producers, who many of them come from these community-based organizations and have formed their radio stations prior to Chavez coming into office. And under previous governments, they were underground. They were pirate radio stations. They were not authorized. And through the process of Chavez coming into office, proposing new telecommunications legislation, which they have been a part of, they now have some degree of authorization. And what they are finding is that in their encounters with the state regulators, such as Conatel, which is one of the bodies that regulates media in Venezuela, they are coming up against all kinds of contradictions.
We're speaking with Sujatha Fernandez, the author of Who Can Stop the Drums. Sujatha was many, many times in the barrios and the shanty towns in Caracas, Venezuela, and has written Who Can Stop the Drums to educate people about what's going on down there. What sort of demands are people making? What kind of changes in the lives of people in the barrios did you observe?
Well, I think there are two types. I think on the one hand, there are the demands that Chavez is fully in support of and has been making many changes in his policy to try and accomplish, which are people want their basic needs met. They want education, they want healthcare, they want transport, they want basic services. Many people that live in this kind of self-constructed housing live in extremely precarious conditions. They don't have basic running water, they don't have gas, they don't have electricity. And so many of the demands that they're making are for these quite basic things. And so I think that this is one area that Chavez has been working with community-based organizations, that his policies have very much supported this kind of change. And then I think that the other area, which is where they may come more into conflict, is issues like looking for a different kind of model of development. And so we see indigenous groups in the northwest of the country, for instance, in places like Zulia, saying, we want to stop coal mining in our area because this relies on a model, export-oriented model of development that takes our natural resources and sells them to corporations for the consumption of people that don't even live in this country. And this is a policy that has been continued by the Chavez government. In fact, the Chavez government, a few years after he came into office, proposed to increase the level of coal mining in Zulia. And this is where indigenous organizations, together with community media organizations, came out onto the street, protested outside Miraflores.
Near Flores is the presidential palace.
Sorry, the presidential palace. And this is one area where they're saying, we don't just want to continue, you know, the exploitation of petroleum, which is Chavez's big thing, and the exploitation of natural resources to fulfill these demands. We want to rethink a new kind of structure. We want a new kind of state apparatus that's not just the same state that was there under previous governments. That needs to be reformed.
The state apparatus is not totally independent of the economic elites who are at the commanding heights of the economy. You have Chavez kind of poised in the middle between these economic elites on one side and the people in the shanty towns on the other. Is there a dynamic to try to transfer power from one to the other? What do you see in terms of that happening, or how might that happen?
Well, the Chavez government's approach has been, I mean, he has encountered so many problems through the state apparatus, through the kind of old elites who still control state institutions, who Ministry of Housing, Ministry of Education, I mean, all of the people from the old political parties and the old elites are still in these institutions. And there's a lot of corruption, there's a lot of bureaucracy. One of Chavez's main approaches to this problem has been to create a whole new set of institutions. And so on the one hand, he has created the missions, which are a sort of alternative means for the oil company, which is called PDVSA, to directly channel money, which it's from its considerable income, especially when oil prices went up in 2003, to channel money directly from there into the missions, thereby bypassing any of the established state institutions and therefore the elites associated with them, transfer money directly to the people. And I think he's had some degree of success with that, even though the missions themselves have started to replicate some of the problems.
The missions, by those you mean?
So the missions are the what he has set up to distribute funds for education, for healthcare. So, for instance, Misión Barrio Adentro is the mission set up for primary health provision in the barrios. And so there are several of these missions, all with different aims that are completely new, completely set up by Chavez. The money comes directly from the oil company that was restructured itself after the strike and coup that happened in 2001 to the barrios.
How long were you down there, and can you talk about the living conditions, security, and daily violence, and on what level that exists?
Sure. So, I mean, my first trip to Venezuela was in January 2004. I just went for a month, and then I started going down for the summers. I spent 3 months at a time up until 2007. So I spent a total of about between 9 and 10 months. The time that I was there, I lived in a shantytown itself called one of the barrios of a parish called El Valle. And I think actually living in the parish gave me a good sense of what life was like for people. And there's a lot of differences between the shantytowns. I think people think of them all as this one homogenous kind of thing. But really, where I lived was in the popular housing buildings, which are like projects, and are somewhat better off than the more precarious shantytowns up in the hills that have less access to water, to healthcare, to transportation. So at least we had running water in the house. We didn't have gas. We had electricity. But at the same time, one of the things that was quite striking was problems of security. And I don't want to make too big of a deal of it, because I feel that this is one of the things that does tend to get blown out of proportion. And people often will there's a big stigma around the shantytowns and the violence of the shantytowns. But nevertheless, I think that it is a reality that this is something people have to live with gangs and police and the incursions into the barrios that happen frequently.
You mentioned before, Sujatha, of the problem with these commissions then becoming bureaucratized and corrupt, and that's historically been a problem. But what are social revolutionaries in Venezuela talking about in terms of how to transfer power from the ruling elites into the hands of the workers and peasants and poor people in the cities? How is that accomplished?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that the Chavez government has been talking about for a long time is controlaría social, which is social control, the idea that community organizations and people should be able to monitor the state, should be able to hold it accountable. And therefore, if money is given, say, for a housing project in a barrio, what's likely going to happen is that the contractors will abscond with the money. The people in the barrio will see less than half of it. That happens very frequently. I came across that all the time. And so they're kind of these mechanisms that are being set up. But I think that's only on a very surface level. I think what you're talking about is something at a much more deeper level of how to transfer power and collective responsibility. And this has been one of the biggest problems that the Chavez government has faced. And I think it has been a problem also because of the way that neoliberalism itself has eroded unions, it has eroded structures of representation, it has eroded political parties to the point where community-based organizations is kind of what is left standing after this detritus of neoliberalism has made its way around. And so what Chavez has done is he has, from the top down, he's tried to create a range of these mediating kind of institutions to transfer power power to the local level. You may have heard of the Bolivarian circles. That's something that, you know, yes, people heard of quite often. Communal councils.
What are Bolivarian circles?
So the Bolivarian circles was one of Chavez's first attempts to transfer power, to say, well, let's create these organizations. We'll give money for people to create in their local community a gathering of people from the neighborhood to administer funds, to look at administer the missions, to pretty much govern themselves and create a local municipal kind of or even parish level organizing body. And the problem is, just like with the communal councils that came later and others of these kind of, there have been many, I could kind of list off them all. The problem with them has been that Chavez comes out on his weekly television show and says, we're creating Bolivarian circles. And everybody goes out and creates a Bolivarian circle. And then the press says, we have 100,000 Bolivarian circles functioning in all of Venezuela. And it's so wonderful. And then the Western media here, the left, will say, great, look at these Bolivarian circles. Within a year, they're defunct. Or they're not functioning much. And my argument is it's because it's this top-down attempt to create, to transfer power, doesn't work. And this is where the long-term organizations are saying, why are we trying to create these top-down institutions? We have existed. There are peasant-based organizations. There are workers' organizations, indigenous movements. These have all existed, and these have a long history. What we need to be doing is creating coalitions from the ground up between existing organizations that then have a much stronger base, one for sustainability, to survive beyond Chavez's coming out and saying, let's create something. Secondly, that they have the structures, they have the internal structures for decision making to be able to put their own agenda before the state and have that be represented.
Are there confrontations with the structure of the state and those kind of barrio grassroots organizations, assemblies, et cetera?
There are. And in the book, I talk about a couple of these. I talk about what I had mentioned before, the marches that were carried out in front of the presidential palace by indigenous groups over mining. Another one that I talk about.
Let's stay on the mining one for a second.
Okay.
Whatever happened with that?
So you have the coal mining. What happened? Well, they were successful in deterring the Chavez government's plans to increase coal mining. Their demands were to bring it back to zero, which was below what it was before the Chavez government came, and they weren't successful in doing that. And that is an ongoing battle with the government over this issue of coal mining.
So at what level is it approximately now?
All I know is that the Chavez government had planned to increase coal mining, and they made the Chavez government back down.
So you're going into some of the more places where the people on the ground have differences with the structure
Correct.
Of even an
right.
anti-neoliberal government. Give us some other examples.
Right. So then another example that I give in the book is the example of Conatel, which I mentioned was the communications. It was set up under a neoliberal administration pretty much to police the airwaves. And so what they did was they went into a community radio station and confiscated its transmitter. And when all came down, the reason why they say they did it was because two frequencies were being shared by a Chavista governor and by this radio station. And so Conatel intervened on the side of the Chavista governor to take it away from the community radio station and give it to the governor. And community media groups responded by occupying the offices of Conatel. And it was an extremely interesting kind of encounter that I detail in the book about all the questions that they were putting. They were saying, you are acting like the functionaries of previous administrations. How can you say you're any different if you will come in and take our transmitter and take one of our comrades into prison? And which is what they did. They arrested one of the people at the radio station. And it brought up a lot of issues about on whose side will the state intervene? Who are they willing to defend if Chavez is going to put out legislation saying we promote community radio stations? Will the state be willing to intervene and defend those community radio stations, even against a Chavista governor who wants that same frequency?
So what was the outcome of this struggle?
So the outcome was that the transmitter was returned, the frequency was returned to the radio station, and they managed to organize a forum for discussion of these issues, and particularly the issue of authorization. Now, in order to get authorization, a community radio station, and we're talking about a small station in a barrio that often starts with no resources, people who often don't even have money to eat every day, and they're required to put in a 300-page application in order to get authorization. And often this means carrying out detailed methodological investigations with complex statistical packets. And they say, how can we do this? This is part of the problem.
We're speaking with Sujatha Fernandez, who's written a book about urban social movements in Chavez's Venezuela. It's called Who Can Stop the Drums? Sujatha, if you were not an American citizen, but a Venezuelan citizen, you were living down there, what political organization would you be in, and what would you be doing? What would you be working for?
I don't even know if you're an American citizen. You're from Australia,
Australian,
right?
Citizen, correct.
Yeah. Okay, I was going to say, you're Australian, right?
Australian, yeah. My imagination was really fired up by the community media people that I met, and they really showed me and convinced me of how important community media is, not just as a means of communication and not just as a means of getting their message out, but as a means of organizing. And these community media stations were nucleuses for the community. There was a show, in addition to just the shows by, say, a housewife doing a cooking show or a young kid having his reggaeton show, which is, you know, a music show, or, you know, just these kind of everyday things. They would have history shows, popular history shows talking about the area. They would have shows for organizing the popular fiestas, for organizing the missions. And often the radio station spaces were also meeting spaces. And so a room that contained all of the equipment for the radio show would have another huge space set up with chairs where often the community would come in and they would have an impromptu barrio assembly. And so they were very much seen as spaces of participation and of activism. It was very frequent for me to walk into a station and see a vibrant assembly going on discussing the health mission, the local health clinic, and how they were going to be organizing that, or a debate about whether they wanted to join the communal council that Chavez was proposing for the area.
I have a question on similarities. I know I saw you quoted Nancy Postero, who's written a book, mm-hmm. but looked at Bolivia from an indigenous point of view in mm-hmm. particular. And in Bolivia, they talk about a man named Tupac Katari, who they mm-hmm. look to equal or even more than Che in terms mm-hmm. of their looking at their indigenous struggle. And you talk about a figure like that in mm-hmm. in Venezuela, mm-hmm. who I'm not really familiar with. And you talk about that person as actually against the, when Bolivar was uh-huh. there, against Bolivar, essentially.
Right. Right.
So just talk about the importance of that figure and the historical memory and how that fits into this struggle or, you know, this confrontation or whatever, even the grassroots way of trying to figure out how to work with Chavez.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something kind of interesting to me and something I couldn't at first get my head around, because this is Chavez's Bolivarian revolution based on the independence figure Simón Bolívar, who was a member of the Creole elite and who was very central in many of the independence movements, not just in Venezuela, but throughout Latin America. And yet people were talking about Boves, and people were talking about what? Boves, the person that you just referred
to.
His name
Boves is his name.
Boves. Okay. And Boves was somebody who is very much an anti-hero, because he got together these marginalized Indians and blacks, and he launched a movement against Simón Bolívar's independence movement. So he's always been a very marginal figure, or kind of not...
And there were questionable politics issues with Bolívar as well, as I recall.
Right, right. So because mm-hmm. Bolívar is himself a member of the Creole elite, a member of the slave-holding mm-hmm. kind of elite, he is someone that... Now, Bolívar is interesting in the popular memory of Venezuelans, because a lot of them have kind of reinvented him. There's a whole cult around Simón Bolívar, as some people say that he used to be a slave. Some people say he's a man of the people who grew up in Barlovento, which is the sort of ex-slave region in the northwest of the country. There are all of these kind of myths about Simón Bolívar himself. So he himself is not an easy person to sort of understand his role. But I think the way that he has traditionally been taken on by governments, and even the Chavez government, has been very much the white Creole elite figure in the official royal regalia, very much a part of that official kind of history. And what Barrio people have been doing through the radio stations, one of the radio stations I looked at was Negro Primero, that's the name of it, and it's also named after a black hero of independence. And what they're trying to do is bring up some of these heroes from the past who have never been a part of this official cult of the independence heroes. So Boves, because he went against the government. Manuel Piar, another hero who tried to start up a regional movement in another state of the country, has also been very much looked down upon because independence was also always seen about unifying the country, bringing it together, and not about fracturing it. And Latin American countries have always had a big fear, whether it's along race lines, regional lines, of fracturing the nation. But what we see in the radio stations is really trying to rescue some of these heroes and these figures and saying, well, why shouldn't we bring up Boves? Why shouldn't we bring up Piar? Why shouldn't we bring up some of these heroes who for us represent black and indigenous people? And more than just representing black and indigenous people, they represent a conflict that has not gone away. Because in Venezuela today, there is still a racial conflict, even though it's not always talked about. And that racial conflict is somewhat represented between bureaucrats, even within the Chavez administration, and the majority black and indigenous population. And so people actually said to me, well, we're talking about the difference between Piar and Bolivar because it is relevant today when we are fighting these bureaucrats, many of whom are white and many of them who are hold prejudices against us people. They think we from the barrios can't manage our own affairs and can't be responsible for ourselves. And that's why these historical figures are still important.
Yeah, you mentioned one scene when you get lost in a in a more white community.
Right, right.
Where you kept asking the women on the street for directions and no one would even acknowledge who
right,
you were.
Right, right.
Which was, I thought, pretty strong.
Right. And then that was a real eye-opener to me about, you know, this is just for me one day. This is, I don't face this every day, but the people who live in the barrios, every time they would have to go into that neighborhood, would face that kind of discrimination.
Now, I'm sure you've thought about this a lot. I don't even know how to ask it, but how would you think about, if you were saying to somebody, what's going on in Latin America, but particularly between Venezuela and Bolivia? Are there parallels between what's happening? I mean, obviously the populations are very different. One is much more indigenous, I mean, Bolivia than Venezuela. One is much bigger. Venezuela's bigger. Both, though, are on an anti-neoliberal structure, at least that's their thinking,
right,
tied into a worldwide structure of neoliberalism. But
right,
how do you compare the what's happening in the grassroots in those places to what the futures are?
Yeah. Well, to me, one of the big differences is that Bolivia was under neoliberal policies for a lot longer than Venezuela. And so pretty much right up until Evo Morales came to power in 2005, Bolivia was had undergone a series of neoliberal governments. It was really the focus of testing out a lot of the very early neoliberal policies. And it had policies like multiculturalism, which was something that was brought in. It had the law of popular participation. All of these laws that really applied neoliberal policies of decentralization to indigenous organizations, which someone like Nancy Postero argues opened up the space in weird ways for these indigenous movements to come forth at the same time as those laws never really intended to give popular power to the people or to recognize, you know, different cultures. It just sought to give them on a very superficial level while denying them access to resources and denying them, you know, real structural change. Whereas Venezuela, the Carlos Andrés Pérez was the president who came to power and in the early 90s began to bring around this neoliberal change, and it was always very contested in Venezuela. Venezuelans, they had been very accustomed to having their oil wealth, to having that somewhat redistributed under previous governments, and to have a government come in and say, you know, we're going to take this away from you, we're going to cut back on all these services, was something that they were not as willing to accept as people in
That's
other
interesting.
Countries.
Yeah, Bolivia didn't have any of that. I mean, they just left everybody in poverty,
right,
really.
Exactly. And Venezuela also, I mean, the poverty level, the extreme poverty level did rise significantly. I think it was 66% when Chavez took office. So there was quite important changes made in Venezuela during the period of the 90s. It's just that neoliberalism never really had the chance to become as consolidated a system in Venezuela as it did in some other countries. And so to me, I think that's a big difference. In the process of fighting neoliberalism, many of the organizations in Bolivia, the miners groups, the peasants organizations, the indigenous groups, I mean, many of these groups became very strong and very vocal. I think that's another difference in Venezuela, where many of these community-based organizations developed in tandem with Chavez and through his earlier coups. And there's much more of a kind of symbiosis that developed over the period of the 90s as compared to this very confrontational, you know, that led to the deposing of several presidents and a very volatile situation in Bolivia that didn't happen to the same extent in Venezuela. So those are the differences that I see. I think that though we can see a lot of similarities, I think that Chavez and Morales are pursuing very similar kind of policies relating to nationalizations, relating to welfare, relating to reversing neoliberal forms. So I won't be surprised if we see a similar process unfolding in Bolivia to what's happening in Venezuela.
The other striking figure in your book, which I think would be different than Bolivia, it was just striking though about Venezuela, was that 93% of the people are urbanized.
Yes.
I mean, I read that, and if you had asked me before I read that number what I thought Venezuela looked like, I would have said 50% are living on farms or doing other things, which is like Bolivia. Bolivia, you know, does not have that level of urbanization.
Right.
But 93% in Venezuela.
Well, Venezuela, I mean, Venezuela has always tended towards greater urbanization because of the very nature of oil production has brought people away from the countryside into the cities and into the sort of areas where there are jobs related to oil. Oil created a huge bureaucracy, the oil wealth itself. And so historically in Venezuela, more so because of the oil, there's always been a greater tendency towards urbanization.
Who Can Stop the Drums, Urban Social Movements in Chavez's Venezuela by Sujatha Fernandez. It's a really wonderful book. We urge people to go out and get it. Sujatha, towards the end of the book, you make this observation, not yours
Marks,
initially,
right?
But nonetheless one that's worth reading and asking
and we don't mean
you to comment on. In the end, it is people who make history, but not under circumstances of their own making. Well, of course, Marx said that, and I just want to know your reflections on that famous observation, having spent all that time in the barrios of Venezuela.
See, this is the thing, is I feel that, for me, that kind of phrase of Marx really rung true, because so much, I think, of what we get about Venezuela is either there are so many obstacles and there's, you know, it's really these structural changes that neoliberalism has brought about will never be able to change anything. And then you get the sort of one attitude on the left, which is very celebratory and very much about, you know, participation and how all of these, you know, people are in Venezuela are just making a revolution and participating. And to me, that phrase by Marx brings us back to what I see more as the reality, which is that there is an attempt by people. What I saw was this real attempt by people to change the conditions in which they live and to really bring about a different kind of world and to envision a different kind of future. But they are not completely free to do that. And it's not just the boundaries and the obstacles that they face at the national level, but that we are living in a profoundly different era of global capitalism to what the Cubans faced in the 60s, to what the Nicaraguans faced, to what many other social revolutions have faced. And that is one where it is a much more unipolar world. There is no Soviet Union to appeal to go outside to. And it is one where neoliberalism has created a much more interconnected world. It's harder to make socialism in one country, which is the kind of phrase that people had talked about previously.
It was always hard.
It was always hard.
but you know,
it's a good explanation.
If we could do a little better here, I think it would take some of the heat off of the people in Venezuela.
Well, we want to thank you. I have one last question, which Michael usually asks, but of course we know your sister, Deepa Fernandez, very well. And it's interesting to me, and I know you're both from Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you get the politics from?
We were both very involved in politics ever since. For myself, I was a student activist for many years, and then I joined, you know, a socialist group, youth organization, and so for me, we were involved in, you know, fighting questions from student fees to East Timor, Indonesia, very involved in a lot of these issues in the region, and so getting involved with Latin America just sort of felt like a natural progression of, you know, that kind of activism from Australia.
Well, thank you. This is really it's an important book. Sujatha Fernandez, who wrote this book called Who Can Stop the Drums? Urban Social Movements in Chavez's Venezuela. So thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thank you, Sujatha.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
talk today with John Tito Gerassi, author of Unrepentant Radical Educator. The book encompasses the life, times, and activism of John Tito Gerassi. A lifelong political animal and radical educator, Tito has lived his critical pedagogy on the barricades and the front lines of the movement. As a newsman for Time, Newsweek, and the New York Times, as a blacklisted professor exiled in Europe, as a Korean War Green Beret, and as a best-selling author of The Great Fear in Latin America and 9 other books. Jean-Paul Sartre, a friend of his, said about him, "I trust no one more than Gerassi to make me understand America." Ex-journalist, current professor at Queens College, John Tito Gerassi, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Glad to see you.
Tito, let's just jump right into this. It's a wonderful book, Unrepentant Radical Educator, that you did along with an ex-student of yours, Tony Manchinsky. I wanted to ask you, because one chapter is better than the next, but you tell this great story about Henry Luce, the emperor of Time Life magazine media, like the current Fox News and the guy that owns that. That's what he was in those days, and you went to work for him. What did he tell you the first day about being a reporter for that empire?
Oh, when I finally got the past my tryout period, I was sent up to see him, and I walked into his office, and he had this enormous half-moon type of desk on which there was a blotter, leather type thing with two pens sticking out, an in and an out box. There was nothing in either boxes. And, you know, he had basically a squeaky voice, right? And he looked down at his blotter, which has nothing on it, and he said, "I hear you're coming aboard, Mr. Gerassi." I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, you know, we here at Time think that objectivity is neither feasible nor desirable." And then he looked up and I to my eyes and stared and said, "Any questions?" I said, no, sir. And he said, "Welcome aboard." That was it.
Yeah, well, but then later on, he invited you out to his house for dinner, didn't he?
Oh, that was later, yeah.
Yeah, and you really put your foot in it.
Oh, boy, and how I lost.
You could have been the art critic.
Yeah. In a way, because of what happened in my life, I'm glad I didn't. But for a while, I regretted because I could have. Art critic was a great job, right? You spent a day going to galleries. You spent a day writing it up, and that was it. And if you wanted to go cover a story in the Chicago Art Museum or San Francisco, you know, so you put it in and you got paid, you know, to go and so on. So at the time, I was very unhappy about that. But on the long run, I'm sure glad that was a great, great thing that happened to me, that I got kicked out of the art section. And the reason I got kicked out is because at that dinner, which is automatic, if you stayed at the Time for a year, you either get a huge raise, which I did, and you get invited for dinner at Luce's house, or you don't, and they just wait for you to leave because, or they transfer you around from section to section. I was a little disappointed. I thought I was such a smart ass that I thought that was me, right? I didn't know it was an automatic thing for anybody there. And so when the limousine came to pick me up, there was John McPhee, the New Yorker writer who got hired same time I did. Another guy who had, three of us had gotten hired the same week. And they were already in the limousine. So that was my first disappointment, right? And the second was that art never came up, you know, during the dinner, except towards the end when Luce asked me, "What did I think of Andrew White?" And I said, "I remember just two words, slick and sentimental."
Perfect.
And he nodded, you know, interesting. That was the end of the conversation on art in front of everybody. Right. All the managing editors and the business types, everybody was there. It was a big, enormous dinner. And all the wives. But the wives, the women in general, were not invited to the smoking room. That takes place after dinner for coffee, espresso, and cognac, and cigars. By the way, the cigars were Cuban cigars, right?
Of course.
He asked me at one point, "What did I think of Jackson Pollock?" And I said, "I was America's first great classic painter." And he said, "Oh, really?" And next day I showed up at my office at 11 o'clock. We always worked late, came in relatively. 11 o'clock, I walk in, and there's a guy sitting at my desk. I said, "Who the hell are you?" And he said, oh, you must be Gerasi. You're in Latin America. And I didn't know the difference at the time, the difference between Paraguay and Uruguay. Nothing.
I didn't even know the difference between Latin America and
But I had put in before that shift to the senior editor, and he apparently had already approved it, a trip in Latin America, or specifically to Uruguay, to do a story on the Torres Garcia School, which I had thought I discovered wasn't very well known in the time.
Torres Garcia is a painter.
Yeah. I wanted to do a story, and I had suggested that I do art in Latin America in general, that I go everywhere. That still was approved, since it sort of combined with Latin America anyway. So both senior editors approved it. And so I got this fantastic trip throughout Latin America. And that was the beginning of my real radicalization. Because I began with Venezuela, where everybody adored, I mean, at the time, Perez Jimenez, the dictator, right? When I got there, I talked around. I went to a few galleries and so on. And there was one particular painting I remember at a gallery that I really liked. And I said, who's the guy? He's Manaure. I still remember his name, Manaure. And I said, well, can I interview him? He's in jail. So I said, well, with my time credentials, I might be able to interview him in jail. But I had to go to the police headquarters, and they said, sure, you're interviewing him as an artist, right? I said, right, as an artist, right? So I went to see him, and of course, he was one of the leaders of the resistance movement. That's why he was in jail, right? And he told me, passed me a little piece of paper to go see Patricio Ojeda at the university. So I went to Patricio and I with university, and I eventually found Patricio Ojeda. Patricio Ojeda was a 19-year-old student who eventually led the revolution that toppled Perez Jimenez.
Amazing.
He was fantastic. I wish he had taken over. Instead, he said, you know, I'm too young. I can't. And he said, we got to have somebody that's really established and that will probably be respected by the world. And he chose Wolfgang Larrazaba, who then became the temporary president of Venezuela, and eventually allowed for a free election. Of course, it was immediately bought by the United States, and they put in Betancourt.
What year was this?
1958. Okay. It was really too bad because Patricio Ojeda was a fantastic guy. Eventually got killed, went to the hills, eventually joined the FLN in Venezuela, and eventually got killed.
Now, Tito, before we go from your first career as a journalist to your second career as a radical educator, talk to us about Che, because I know you met him in Uruguay and you became friendly with Che. And
there's an essay in here on Che.
Yeah.
It's called again.
But Che, where are you now that we need you or something?
Right. That's right. You were asked, can there ever be another Che, was the question that was posed to you, right?
Why would Che talk to you from the Imperialist Press?
I first met him much later at the Punta del Este conference. Punta del Este was where the Americans had called for, specifically Kennedy at the time, had called for a conference to start the Alliance for Progress. His Secretary of the Economy was his personal representative, Dillon, was the one he sent down. And the one everybody was supposed to meet there at Punta del Este. It was 50 miles from Montevideo. It's a resort area of Uruguay with very fancy hotels and so on. And the representative from Cuba, which was then still part of the community and the OAS hadn't been thrown out yet, was Che Guevara. He arrived late. The New York Times folks, I was New York Times correspondent at that point, in Uruguay, but the regular, the big guys, Juan de Onís and Tad Schultz, knew that Che wouldn't talk to them. So to get rid of me, because by then they knew a little bit my politics, I'd changed radically since my time days, said, you cover Che, right? And so I went out to the airport. They all went to Punta del Este, and I was waiting for Che at the airport. Everybody came down, all the students came to the airport, and when Che arrived, they yelled at him, come speak at the university. So Che agreed to go to the university, so I did too. There was an incident at that point. There was some anti-Castro Cuban exiles who had gone there, and they got into a fight with the pro-Castro students. As we came out of the, Che made a fantastic speech inside the auditorium, and as we came out, there was the rector of the university, there was a policeman, Che, of course, and me, because I was the only guy with a, at that point with the credentials, right, for a newspaper, in this case the New York Times credential. So he came out together, and there was this fight going on outside. The policeman panicked, took out his pistol, fired in the air. But there was an overhang from the auditorium, and the bullet ricocheted, and it hit a guy and killed him. And luck would have it that he was the representative of USIS. He was a Cuban, but working for the American Propaganda Bureau, right? USIS, and he got killed, right? So I'm the only guy that sees it, the only correspondent that saw it, right? So I didn't go up to Punta del Este right away. I rushed to Press Wireless and sent my dispatch. And in brackets, I said, the witness is me. I was there, right? Yeah. New York Times ran the USIS story as it was issued by the New York Times, by the embassy, and ignored mine.
Yeah.
And so a big fight ensued and so on. But meanwhile, I go up to Punta del Este, and I'm supposed to cover Che. Che is booked into the cheapest of all the fancy hotels that were out there. And I try to talk to him here, there, and so on. He says, yeah, no, I saw you at the auditorium, and so on, et cetera. But I don't talk to the Imperialist Press, and you're representing the Imperialist Press. Try to argue with nothing. And at this hotel, they had booked a huge table where all the left-wing characters sat around with Che. And there were all sorts of people there that were correspondents of some place. For example, representing Prensa Latina was a guy who had never been published before by the name of Garcia Marquez. Right? The representative from Monthly Review was Carlos Fuentes, and so on. You know, these guys, and Jorquera, El Perro, El Negro, we used to call him, who became Allende's press secretary, and so on. All of these guys who later became very important throughout Latin America were correspondents there. I tried to get to talk and nothing doing, right? So here they are sitting at a huge table, all talking. I got a table for me alone, as close as I could so I could try to pick up what they were saying. All of a sudden, Che jumps up and with arms open and greets a new guy who came, big hug. Turns out to be very close personal friends. Rogelio Garcia Lupo was his name. He was a correspondent for La Prensa of Argentina and had been a very close friend of Che as kids. They were the same age and so on. So Che eventually introduces him to everybody, pushes, asks the guy next to him to move over so Garcia Lupo, Pajarito, a little bird we called him, could sit next to him. And as he sits down, he sees me way over there. And he says, Che vos, what are you doing over there? Argentines say, hey you, Che vos.
Yeah.
Right? That's how Che got his nickname, Che. Right? Che says, you know him? I said, yeah, he's a great guy. He said, well, he works for the Imperialist Press. And Garcia Lupo says, I work for La Prensa. That's even worse than the Times. Right? So they invited me over. Another chair had to be pushed, and I sat down next to Che on the other side. I was there for all the meals. They all took their meals together. And the last meal, at the last time before Che left, he's made all the people there. He said, by then he found out that I had gotten this incredible telegram, commissioned me to do a book on Latin America in general, which turned out to be The Great Fear in Latin America, right? That was published.
Best-selling book in those days.
But he turned around and he said, okay, you're going to go to all their countries? I said, yes. So he turned to the crowd and he said, I want you all to give me your word that you're going to show this gringo correspondent what the gringos never see. Take him around when he gets there. And sure enough, when I went to see Allende, for example, El Perro met me at the airport and took me, and I stayed at the Casa Moneda while I was there and so on.
Let me get you back to this book. There is a chapter on Che. The book is called Unrepentant Radical Educator. We're speaking with what we call Tito Gerassi, John Gerassi, and we've been talking about Che. And just a simple question here on Che. It says the essay is called Che, Where Are You? And what was your answer to Che, Where Are You? This is after his death, I presume,
yes,
right?
Right.
And what was the answer?
My answer was that eventually there will be many Che's. Don't worry. Latin America will eventually win, I said to my students. Right?
And how many years ago was that?
10 years ago.
All right, a good answer. Heidi?
Oh, a chapter that I think we all enjoyed is titled Albert Camus in Action, Dissension or Abstention.
And you talk a bit about Camus and Sartre.
Yeah, eventually, that originally was a chapter to be part of a debate between the pro-Sartre and anti-Camus and pro-Camus. And it was commissioned by the Chicago University Press. But the guy who was the editor of it, who was to put it together, was so pro-Camus, both in his own introduction and in his choice of articles, that Chicago decided not to publish it. It was eventually published by somebody else, I don't remember who. But that's my article, and it was basically an answer to another article that was pro-Camus that was written by a student of mine who by then had graduated, was teaching philosophy in somewhere in Illinois, I think. So my article was never published, right, and excluded from there. So I sent it to France, and it was Sartre sent me a note, a little note saying, I can't publish it. You're too pro-me. It looks like a puff job and so on. But we'll send it over to Esprit. Esprit was a French Catholic, but extremely liberal and almost, could be said, leftist publication. It had been started by Mounier. Mounier was the head of the resistance during the Second World War, the non-communist resistance. And he had traveled to England to talk to de Gaulle at de Gaulle's request. And what apparently de Gaulle told him was, yes, go ahead, make the alliance with the communists. And so he came back. He was betrayed by somebody. Sartre always believed it was a communist who betrayed him. Was caught by the Germans. And he was tortured to death by Klaus Barbie.
Wow. Kind of thing.
But the article appeared.
Tell us about, you know, this debate. I mean, maybe all our listeners don't know, but the issue between Sartre and Camus, which, you know, I interpret in some way as, you know, a person who says life is absurd, you know, Camus and what's the purpose and all this, and Sartre, who's a person of action and, you know, talks about it differently. But what is that debate? And that's what you take on here, take on Camus's, you know, novels, and particularly The Plague and The Stranger. But what is the debate?
Well, the debate really has began with a choice that Sartre had to do. Camus was part of the group that created the Temps Moderne, the Modern Times, the French magazine that was directed by Sartre. Malraux was a member before he became a Gaullist. There was all sorts of intellectuals that had agreed to create this magazine. And one after another fell out if they didn't accept the choice that Sartre made. And Sartre's choice defined the magazine from then on. And what he said was, yes, it's terrible what's happening in Russia. Yes, we will denounce those trials that bring all the intellectuals and execute them, et cetera, et cetera. But we live in a time of very risky where the Third World War is possible. Which country is capable of starting World War III? Only the United States. Russia would never start World War III. He didn't even know at the time that the United States had a first strike policy and Russia didn't. Right? But he just, from analyzing the situation in the world, he said the United States is capable of starting World War III in order to dominate the world. Now, it is true that at the time, everybody, Russians and Americans and the Temps Moderne people thought that if there is a Third World War, and it's an atomic war, the radiation dissipates in the atmosphere and disappears. So that although it was clear that an atomic bomb could blow up all of Moscow, it wouldn't necessarily mean the end of the world. Right? That became known much later, in part thanks to the trial of the Rosenbergs. Right?
I would say this leads into your story in the Rosenbergs.
Right, exactly.
But
yeah. Anyway, so Sartre said, Russia is capable of starting World War III.
Russia's not capable. Russia is, U.S. is.
Right. Russia is not. The United States is. And in addition, in France, locally, the Communist Party represents the workers. You know, 90% of the unionized workers were members of the CGT. CGT is communist. Right? We cannot go against the communist orders when it affects working conditions in France. Right? They represent the workers, and that's what the workers want. So for those two reasons, we are going to support the communist forces in France and on a world scale. Now, Camus, of course, denounced that. Camus ended up taking the position that he can't support anything. The only thing he was asked point blank at one point, well, what are you in favor of? Republican Spain. This isn't in the 50s, right? I mean, Republican Spain doesn't exist, right? Eventually, the breakup got to the tombe down in print because Camus was ignored. They did not take back the criticism on the myth of Sisyphus, where Camus had the position that life is pushing the rock up the hill, letting it fall back and pushing it back up and so on, and identifying with the effort of pushing the rock up the hill like Sisyphus did, right? Nor did the tombe moderne have second thoughts about The Stranger. They considered it a first-rate novel, and they stayed that way. But all of a sudden, Camus starts publishing strange things, like, for example, The Plague. The Plague is a sort of allegory about German occupation. But it says the plague comes to this country. Nobody can do anything against the plague. There's no explanation of why it came, no explanation about anything about the plague. Nevertheless, the doctors fight against it. And in Camus' novel, they continue to fight against it. All of a sudden, the plague goes away. And the tombe moderne's answer was, you can't claim that the Germans came, we can't explain anything about it, and then the Germans go away. The Germans are the creation of conditions that existed in France and in Germany and so on in the world. That's why there was a Second World War. And they don't go away because resistors kept doing the resistance. They go away because they were defeated. And they were defeated in part because the Allies and in part because of the resistance.
An unrepentant radical educator. I want to recommend, if people want to hear more of these amazing stories and views about politics, which are utterly incredible, to get this book, Unrepentant Radical Educator. John Gerassi and his co-author, who interviewed him and wrote some of it.
And it's published by Sense Publishers. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tito. Great to talk to you.
Believe me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.